Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 173 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on prn.fm, or download the MP3 after broadcast with iTunes or other podcast apps. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. Remember that you will be responsible for any long-distance charges you incur. Remember that I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you would like to sponsor the show as an individual or advertiser, please contact me. You can donate via PayPal using the email david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com or make monthly donations at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Even a few dollars a month helps. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you're gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on just about any of the topics I've covered in my shows, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. Now let's go to this week's interview. Dr. Robert Bob Dixon is the past president of Change for Children, past president of Tools for Peace, past chair of the board of directors of Arusha Cross Cultural Center. He was a senior partner with Results Canada with a mandate to end starvation, debilitating diseases, and poverty globally in support of the Millennium Development Goals for many years. He was instrumental with Results Canada in maternal and child health being the signature initiative of the 2010 G8 G20 Forum in Toronto, and the ensuing announcements of over $1 billion and later $3.4 billion for maternal and child health committed by the Canadian government. As well, he volunteers with Medical Mercy Canada, most recently in Thailand with the Burmese refugees, and in Nepal, and is on the board of the Four World Center for International Development. He helped lead the anti-fluoridation program in Calgary, which resulted in water fluoridation being halted in 2011. He's still involved in this issue. In October 2017, he launched a website for safewatercalgary.com, a new organization that he founded. He's also worked with Project Ixkanan since 2003 to rebuild and support the village of El Remate in the Petén province of northern Guatemala. He's worked on climate change issues with Calgary Citizens on Climate Change since 2015, including meetings with elected officials at municipal and provincial governments. He helped them host the Federal Climate Change Forum and has authored white papers on this issue. He brought George Marshall from Climate Outreach in the UK to Calgary for a series of workshops to promote respectful communication. However, the reason he's here today is because he recently co-authored an article, "Fluoride is Not Only Pointless, It's a Health Risk," with dentist Dr. Hardy Limeback, former head of preventive dentistry at the University of Toronto, now retired. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Thank you for having me, Dave.
This is a little bit unusual because we're actually in the same room at the same time. So I'm kind of excited to do something different for a change. So let's talk about fluoridation in Calgary, because Calgary, for people that don't know, is a city now of over a million. It's a major Canadian city. And for many years, it was not fluoridated while other cities were. And then there was a plebiscite that resulted in it being fluoridated, and then it was unfluoridated again. So how many plebiscites did it take before fluoridation was actually accepted in Calgary?
Well, there's been six plebiscites in total, David, and I just might add that medicine by plebiscite is a very, very poor way of doing any kind of medicine or any healthcare. But
some people would say a lot of things are not well done by plebiscite.
That's true.
Yes.
So there was four plebiscites starting back in the 60s, and the first four plebiscites defeated fluoridation. And it was usually not by large margins, but they all four defeated it. Then in 1989, the Alberta Health Services put a lot of money into health, into the Calgary Health Region, and that allowed them to put out a lot of, well, misinformation, in my opinion, and allowed them to win the vote, the fluoridation vote, in 1989. And so then it took them a year or two to get that process all through, and they started fluoridating in 2001. And then in
2001, you said the plebiscite was 89.
Oh, I'm sorry, in, 89. Sorry, in 1991.
91, yeah, okay.
And then there was a big push against fluoridation, and there was a second plebiscite in 1998. That was also involved with an expert, so-called expert panel that the University of Calgary essentially chose, the medical school and the people in the community health department chose. And that expert panel was kind of stacked to with pro-fluoridationists. And that expert panel recommended to continue fluoridation at a slightly smaller dose. That was in conjunction then with the plebiscite in 1998. And that one again passed fluoridation by about 54% to 46%. And that's the last plebiscite we had. So a total of six, the first four defeated, the last two were
narrowly approved. And probably the first four were narrow as well.
Yes, they were all.
Yeah, so it was all close. And when fluoridation was taken out, it was taken out by a decision of city council. It was not a plebiscite.
Mm-hmm.
That was 2011?
So just to give you a bit of background, in 1998, I actually voted for water fluoridation because mm-hmm. I believed the information that the Calgary Health Region and Alberta Health had put out. It was very glitzy information and very well done with probably about $250,000 were spent by the pro-fluoridationists at that time. So I voted for it. Shortly thereafter, friends and colleagues came to me and challenged me on that decision to vote for it and asked me if I'd looked at the literature myself. And well, similar to most dentists and most doctors, I hadn't looked at the information. I'd trust the authorities, the powers that be, to give me good information. So at that time, I did look at the information, and I was abhorred by what I found. And so I took it to Dr. James Beck, who was a professor of mine at the University of Calgary Medical School. And he, like me, after looking at the information for a couple of weeks, said, This is awful. This is horrendous. This should be no problem to get fluoride out of the water because there's so much information against it.
And we didn't mention that you are an MD, right?
I'm an MD. Yes, yeah, I'm a family physician.
Okay.
Graduated from the University of Calgary in 1988. And Dr. Beck, James Beck, is a PhD MD who is, mm-hmm. As I say, a mentor of mine at the University of Calgary. And so we tackled, starting in 1999, we started working with city council and with deans of medical schools and the medical officers of health, the dental officers of health, but primarily with city council. And that resulted in city council in 2011 voting fluoride out of the water, so ending water fluoridation in 2011 by the vote of 10-3, which was quite substantial.
Right. So when the pro-fluoridationists agreed to reduce the dosage, I think from 1 part per million to 0.7, what was the reason that they felt the reduction was necessary? Was this window dressing, or were there some issues that were coming out at that time?
It actually went from 1.2 parts per million to 1 part per million to 0.8 parts per million, and to the present day, 0.7 parts per million. And that was their response to concerns and more studies coming out anti-fluoride. So of all the potential harms, right, from basically the brain to the entire neurological system to thyroid, to kidneys, to bones, and even some types of cancers. So that's their response is, oh, you're safe because we're lowering the concentration.
So if somebody does a study that shows, say, bone damage at 1 part per million, if we're at 0.9, then obviously there's not a problem.
That's essentially the message they're putting out, yes.
Okay, I understand.
You laugh. I don't find it that funny.
Well, I have a dark sense of humor, but you're right. It's not funny. But the contortions that these people will go to try to preserve something that they decided was good, and as evidence comes out, they just kind of retreat slowly. They're not going to.
They negate it. They bury it. They do whatever they can to sideline the information that's coming out, the new studies, the new science.
Right. Now, it sounds very scientific and mathematical that you have a dose of 1.2 parts per million.
It's not a dose, it's a concentration.
Right, that's what I was going to say. So what is, if I'm a baby, if I'm an old person with weak kidneys, if I'm a healthy young adult, like how does my dose differ based on that? Like how much fluoride will I absorb depending on my health status, my age, things like that?
Yes, there's so many variables involved there, David. You're right on that. The main point to be made, though, is they always talk about concentration and always try to assure people that they're safe because they're lowering the concentration, and this is a safe concentration. Well, Health Canada, after request through Freedom of Information, could not provide a single study on safety of water fluoridation with hydrofluorosilicic acid. So by saying that they're lowering the concentration that you're safe is very misleading and fallacious. So essentially, if you're a 100-pound woman that's running marathons, for instance, and drinking, let's say, 10 glasses of fluoridated water a day,
mm-hmm.
and I am 200-pound person and I'm an office worker and I'm drinking one glass a day, then that 100-pound person is getting 10 times the dose that I am getting,
right,
and 20 times the dosage,
right,
because she's half the weight that I am.
Right, like the dose per unit weight, or
yes,
or,
exactly.
Or whatever.
Dosage,
right.
is quantity of drug per kilogram.
Right. Now, you also said that babies that are being fed with formula are also at greater risk?
Very great risk, because they have a smaller body mass, obviously, and they're getting a large concentration or large dose of fluoride if they're being fed by fluoridated water used to make their formula.
I thought it was, you're much more expert on this than me, but was it people with kidney problems who also have trouble with fluoride?
Yeah, ironically, the Kidney Foundation of Canada has quietly withdrawn their support for water fluoridation because they've finally admitted that there's a lot of potential damage to kidneys, and particularly in people that have kidney disease or on dialysis, it's very detrimental.
So when Calgary put in water fluoridation, did they put in any alternatives for people who might be more sensitive to fluoride? Like if you were, let's say that, you know, your doctor didn't think that you should be drinking fluoridated water because of your kidney or something like that, was there any consideration given to that? Any alternatives to city water with fluoride?
Absolutely nothing. There's no safeguards, there's no controls, there's no monitoring, there's no follow-up ever. There's no informed consent for this mass medication that's going on. So as a doctor, if you were to come to me as a patient, I was to give you a medication and I didn't tell you what that drug was doing and I never followed you up again, never monitored you, I just said, take as much as you want for the rest of your life, well, I think you'd probably be looking for another doctor.
Well, you should be looking for another doctor. People are very trusting of their physicians. One of the things you said in this article that I cited, which I believe was published in a Canadian media outlet, what's the name of
it? It's Troy Media.
Troy Media.
Mm-hmm.
Is that Canadian?
Yes.
It's Canadian. Okay. So you said there have never been randomized placebo-controlled studies. So what would a study like that entail? And
well, there's never been anything like that done, and so that's one reason why the pro-fluoridationists can't really say that they have good information out there. So to do a placebo-controlled, double-blinded study would be extremely expensive and extremely difficult, and there's no one funding anti-fluoridation studies or work at this.
Well, point. It's not anti-fluoridation to do good science, right?
Yes. Good
it shouldn't
Thank
be.
You. It shouldn't be.
It shouldn't be, right?
Like, but if the pro-fluoridationists can say every day of the year that the fluoride is safe, why would we have to do anything? Then they shut down any further science.
Well, I kind of liken it to a drug company that has a drug and they know there's some problems, and so they're doing everything in their power to stop certain studies because they kind of know what might be found.
Exactly.
And so as long as you don't do the study, you can claim that there's no evidence.
Exactly. They bury science. They refuse to do more studies. So they can say it's safe without any backup, really.
In Calgary, were there reports of adverse effects from fluoride? I mean, it's not that easy to tell, right? If there's something in your water over a long period of time, did people notice like dental fluorosis, modeling of teeth, or were there other issues that seemed to be related to fluoride?
Yeah, again, if you don't take a temperature, you're not going to find a fever. If you don't look for fluorosis or other damage, like to bones, for instance, you're not going to find it. So it's pretty hard to tease that out. With over 15,000 licensed chemicals, we're in a virtual chemical soup here in our society.
Right.
And a lot of these things have been studied only in silos, only individually.
Right.
And therefore, we don't know the synergies. You don't know what happens when those are come together in our bodies or in our...
Right. And plus, as we've already talked about, you don't actually know the dosage that an individual is getting.
Exactly.
So one individual might be sick and has a high dose of fluoride. Another individual is sick and has a low dose. And who's to say whether either of those sicknesses is related?
Exactly. It's very difficult to tease that out. Someone might have very low iodine levels, and then they're much more susceptible to thyroid disease from fluoride.
Oh, okay.
Fluoride is a thyroid enzyme toxin or inhibitor. And if you have low iodine, you're... much more susceptible to problems.
Right, which could vary with your individual metabolism, or you may have a very restricted diet.
Lots of reasons.
Causes that kind of malnutrition. You also talked about the Cochrane Collaboration, which is a very highly respected evidence-based medicine organization. What have they said about fluoridation?
Yeah, the Cochrane Collaboration is probably the gold standard of medical studies in the world, medical evaluation. And in 2015, they did a major study of pro-fluoridation. And they found that there was only 19 studies that had any validity, really. And out of those, only three had been done since 1975. So their take on it was, really, folks, you pro-fluoridationists, you don't have a lot of literature to stand on here.
Right. Another argument in favor of fluoridation in Calgary was that so they said that our water is naturally contains fluoride from 0.1 to 0.4 parts per million.
Mm-hmm.
So when they were coming out with the 1.2 or the 0.7 or whatever that the concentration was in the water, did that take into account that there was already fluoride in the water?
Yes, they say what they're doing is simply topping up the natural fluoride in the water, and that's a very contentious point. They're right about the 0.1 to 0.4. Generally speaking, our Bow River system that feeds the north part of Calgary has about 0.2 parts per million of natural calcium fluoride,
mm-hmm.
which is quite different than hydrofluorosilicic acid, which is scrubbed out of the fertilizer stacks in the southern United States and
right.
China, and comes to us with a lot of other contaminants like
right.
arsenic and lead and strontium and other sorts of things that are not good for us. So we have those 0.2 parts per million in North Calgary, 0.3 parts per million approximately in the Elbow system for South Calgary. But again, it's calcium fluoride, which is handled, treated much differently in the body
right.
than hydrofluorosilicic acid, which is ionized instantly as it hits the water. So calcium fluoride is quite tightly bound.
Right.
There's not very little of it's released in the body. So if we take that in, we don't actually get much of it into our system,
okay.
into our blood, into our cells, crossing the blood-brain barrier, crossing the placental barrier.
Right, right. I mean, that's an important point. I mean, it's kind of like mercury, the form of mercury has a big impact on how toxic it is when you're exposed to it. Doesn't mean that any level is safe, but there's a big difference between, say, metallic mercury and ethyl or methyl mercury.
Exactly.
Sounds like similar things here. So there was a study, if you can call it that, the McLaren study that claimed that after fluoridation stopped in Calgary, cavity rates went up, I think, in children. And this was more than in our sister city of Edmonton, which remains fluoridated?
Or? Yes, Edmonton's been fluoridated since, I believe it's 1967.
Okay.
It continues to be to this day.
Right. So is that a good characterization of the study? And what was wrong with it? What do you think was wrong with it?
Dr. Lindsay McLaren came out with that data. It's a comparative study, as you said, between Edmonton and Calgary kids in grade 2 in February of 2016. The press immediately took information from there, and whether it came from Dr. McLaren and her camp or whether the press just misconstrued it and ran with that, we're still not quite sure. But they came up with some very erroneous information. They sensationalized it all across Canada,
mm-hmm.
and it actually went to other parts of the world
right.
as well. And the headlines basically glared out there and said that Calgary's kids' teeth are so much worse than Edmonton's.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because they stopped fluoride in 2011. Well, that is so erroneous. And there's a very good counter study out there now, or publication that's done by seven PhDs, MDs, toxicologists, and that's been published by the same journal that published McLaren's study. It took them a year and a half to get that study into that journal because the editor of the journal is very, very pro fluoride. But they finally got that study out. They also let Dr. Lindsay McLaren and her team look at that counter, that rebuttal before it was published, which is, I think, highly unethical. But anyway, back to the study. So there's a lot of problems with it, and actually you should read that CDOE rebuttal study to get all the nuances and all the information and facts and figures. But it points out a lot of things, like there's a lot fewer kids in Calgary in the study than there were in Edmonton. Calgary's kids' teeth actually started better than Edmonton's in 2004. The study was 2004 to 2014. Mm-hmm. So in 2004, there's something like 2.6 cavities per kid in Calgary, and there was about four in Edmonton.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. Now, during the course of that 10-year period, the levels increased more rapidly. The amount of caries increased more rapidly in Calgary than they did in Edmonton. And so in 2014, when the study ended, they're almost identical.
Mm-hmm.
Calgary might even have been slightly higher than Edmonton's, but they're almost identical, around six cavities per child. And so that's a marked increase in Calgary, but it's also a significant increase in Edmonton, which is and was fluoridated. But what Dr. McLaren didn't do, or the information she left out, was information she had just on Calgary kids in 2009, before we stopped fluoridation in 2011. And that information actually showed that almost all the increase in Calgary's kids' caries or cavities happened before 2009, while Calgary was still fluoridated.
Mm-hmm.
And so Calgary stopped fluoridation in 2011, and then the rate of increase in primary kids' cavities in Edmonton and Calgary are almost identical. Actually, maybe even slightly less of a rate of increase in Calgary than in Edmonton post-fluoridation.
Okay.
So that's very significant, and she did not include that data. So considering that all that increase, or almost all the increase in cavities in Calgary happened while Calgary was still fluoridated, 2004 to 2009, it's very disingenuous to say that stopping fluoridation is the cause of increased caries.
Right, and what does it say about scientific ethics that information was withheld? I mean, without it, if that information being included, the paper would have been not very dramatic.
Yeah,
it would have been, you know, our cavities were increasing with fluoride, and they've been increasing after we stopped.
Mm-hmm.
So it implies that there's something else going on. Like, what things could be causing an increase in cavities in children in both Edmonton and Calgary, regardless of whether you're fluoridated or not?
That is really pretty obvious if you look at the global literature. Obesity in kids is increasing markedly all across the world, especially in the developed world, and caries and cavities are increasing in virtually every country, whether we're fluoridated or not.
And the food that causes the greatest amount of obesity, of course, is sugar.
Absolutely, sugar. And as you, I'm sure you're aware, you might even have done some programs on, is that the sugar industry really buried science for a lot of years and really controlled and manipulated the research that was done and pushed the research towards fats, saturated fats, and such to be the demons, to be the devil.
Yeah, my favorite food scam that I talk about all the time is low-fat Greek yogurt. Because Greek yogurt is, by definition, is high fat, like 10% or something like that. It's very thick because it has a lot of fats. But there is fat-free Greek yogurt. So how do they do that? Well, if you read the ingredients, they put cornstarch in it. So it's basically... it's not like Jell-O. Are those puddings that are full of cornstarch,
yeah,
right?
Gelatin, yeah.
Yes. So in order to get the mouthfeel of high fat, after demonizing fat and persuading people that they shouldn't eat fat, they put in a high carbohydrate product and tell people it's healthy, just like Greek yogurt. I mean, I think it's just horrible scam on people, and so many people are becoming obese because they're trying to avoid fats. And if you can't eat fats, what are you going to eat? You're going to eat carbohydrates. But anyway.
And you look at the European diets, very high in fats, and they're in so many ways so much healthier than we are.
I read a book by Nina Tickholtz, a Canadian writer, Big Fat Surprise, and she talked about some of this. She did a lot of really good research. Considering she's not a scientist, it was really good research on some of these older studies in the 1950s, I think, where they sort of first came up with how healthy a low-fat diet was. Mm-hmm. They apparently went to Crete, and they did their research during Lent, where people don't eat fat for a short period of time every year. Mm-hmm. And then they claimed on that basis that Crete had a low-fat diet. Well, I'm sure the first thing you do in Crete after Lent is like you eat the fatted calf, right?
You load up on your fats, for sure.
Again, it's unethical, a little bit like this McLaren study where you've got data that's counter to the narrative you want to push, so you just don't put the data forward.
Exactly, yeah. It's puzzling to me why McLaren hasn't done anything about it. So either she lied about what her study found, mm-hmm. and put out the facts and figures that that Calgary's kids' teeth are a lot worse post-fluoridation, or I think probably what happened is the press took that and massaged it or misconstrued it and then put that out nationally. But whichever way it is, she didn't correct it.
Right. I think, yeah, if you're a scientist and people are abusing your research, you have a responsibility to make a public statement.
Yes.
I mean, if people ignore your public statement, well, at least you've tried.
Yeah.
But if you stay silent, then you're obviously happy with it.
You're complicit.
You're definitely complicit, yeah, in it. One of the things you said that was interesting, and this was also true of me. I graduated in science, and I believed in everything science did, whether it was fluoridation or vaccination or whatever. I was on board, right? Mm-hmm. Even though I knew nothing about this particular area, it's my area of science.
But you trust the powers that be.
I was a believer in science. I joined the team, right? Mm-hmm. So my team was always good, right? It was the ref was, you know, when the ref, you know how it is with a hockey team or a football team, if the ref blows the whistle against your team, the ref's corrupt. But if it's against the other team, the other team is corrupt. I've read a little bit of old stuff about fluoride, and it seemed like some of the real strong opponents of fluoride, like in the 50s and 60s, were extremely right-wing politicians, and that all the progressives were on board with fluoridation. And I think there's been a shift, and I think there's been a lot more focus on science rather than this is a communist plot or something like that. I mean, have you seen a shift in the kinds of people who are opposing fluoridation over the years?
Yes, I think you're right there. Dr. Grant Hill, who was a medical officer of health for Calgary way back in the 50s and 60s, was strongly opposed to fluoridation. I think he probably had some right-wing leanings as well.
Well, he was a member of parliament for the Reform Party, right?
No, that's a different... it's Dr. Hill. I might be mistaken on the first name. Dr. Grant Hill was from High River and more recently was a member of the Reform Party. Yeah.
So okay.
This is a different
different
Dr.
person.
Hill.
Okay.
There's certainly been a big shift there. There's been a lot of people that have stepped out and turned, like I did in 1999, from pro-fluoridation to anti-fluoridation. One of the most notable in Canada would be Dr. Hardy Leinbeck, who I co-authored that article that you mentioned initially. He was just retired recently as the head of preventative dentistry at the University of Toronto, so a very prestigious position. Mm-hmm. And he had the courage to step out in 1998, a year before me, look at the literature and say, "We're wrong, folks. We've got this all wrong."
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so he's since then been an avid anti-fluoridationist and has taken a lot of flack, both privately and publicly,
right?
And in the dental and medical systems. And it's actually even had threats. He could almost write a book, I think, on the things that have happened.
Well,
I would
imagine. I mean, if you were in an institution like a dental faculty that was 100% on one side, and you're the first guy to
step out.
To step out. That's nobody's going to love you for that.
It takes a lot of courage. Dr. John Colquhoun in New Zealand was the actual head. He was appointed the head of the fluoridation movement by the government. They sent him on a worldwide tour in about 1990 and to collect more data, pro-fluoridation mm-hmm. data. He came back and said, folks, we've got this all wrong. It's actually, fluoridation is not beneficial. It's not good in the water. Topically, yes. In the water, no. He was fired.
Yes.
He was fired right out. So he wrote an excellent article, which is still available online, called Why I Changed My Mind About Water Fluoridation. Mm. Dr. John Colquhoun from New Zealand. He is since deceased, but a very, very yeah. excellent article.
And I think the Connets at the Fluorid Action Group have Fluorid Action Network, I guess, have really focused on providing scientific information about fluoride. Yes. Mm-hmm. Because the first anti-fluoridation activists that I met seemed, you know, they said fluoride was bad, but they didn't really seem to have a grasp on the science. But I think now there's a lot out there that if people want to see what the science is and see science that doesn't support fluoride, fluoridation, there's no problem finding that.
There's lots out there. There's over 1,000 decent studies. I mean, if we had gold standard studies, fluoride would be long gone. If the pro-fluoridationists had gold standard studies, we probably wouldn't be here talking about this. Mm-hmm. But none of us have really good, solid science. It's all some decent stuff out there, but nothing really exemplary. But there are over 1,000 studies and more coming out like now every week and month showing that there's a decrease of between 4 to 7 points, IQ points in kids
right.
that grew up with fluoridated water or that their mothers drank fluoridated water during their pregnancy or took some sort of fluoride internally. There's over 4,000 professionals worldwide that have signed on to an open letter to end fluoridation. Again, right. These are people that have risked their reputations and sometimes even their livelihoods. There's about 14 medical laureates, Nobel Prize laureates, and they have come out strongly against fluoride as well. Mm-hmm. One of them called it the biggest scam that's ever been propagated against society. So those people are putting their careers and reputations on the line in many cases.
To go back to some of these studies, I mean, one of the problems I think with some of these studies is they're observational, so that you might have a group of people in one area with no fluoride and a group of people in another area with fluoride, and you can compare them.
Yeah.
But I mean, the first fluoride, pro-fluoride studies, I think in Michigan, like Grand Rapids, Lansing, yeah. there were three towns in
Kingston, yeah.
and they added fluoride to one of the water supplies, and then they claimed there was a massive decrease in cavities, something like that.
Yeah.
People have heavily criticized that study since then, but the same goes on both sides, I think is what you're saying,
yeah.
is it's difficult to find a study where you give randomly select people and give them fluoride or not, and then look at the IQ of their children.
And you have to control so many variables on each side, and it's very difficult to do. And that's McLaren admitted that in her study that she did of Calgary and Edmonton, that there was a lot of variables she tried to control, most of them, but if you really look at the study, very few of those variables were actually well controlled.
Right. I mean, she took information from children in Calgary, but those children, and in Edmonton, I presume, but those children had to volunteer, or their parents had to volunteer.
Right? Parents had to, yeah.
So there is a self-exclusion of a large number of people, and that means that the problem with doing that is that if a lot of people exclude themselves, then you end up with a non-representative sample,
yeah.
and you don't really know the reasons why are people more likely to enter, to allow to be in such a study if they have worse teeth or if they have better teeth, or is there no impact on that?
Yeah, and there's socioeconomic factors there. So, yeah, and there are some differences between Calgary and Edmonton, even though we're in the same province and we're somewhat homogeneous. There are some differences that are quite striking, too. Immigration rate is higher in Calgary, for instance. And so there's a whole lot of variables there that weren't controlled for.
Okay, so around the world with fluoride, it seems like it's mostly a North American thing. Am I right in that? That's
yeah.
where it's...
And one thing the pro-fluoridationists do is try to make it out that this is, that fluoridation is just a global thing, that everybody's doing it, and that we're the outliers here in Calgary. The truth is that less than 6% of the world is fluoridated. Less than 6%.
6% of the world's population.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in British Columbia, for instance, less than 3% are fluoridated. In Quebec, less than 3%. And in Europe, less than 3% are fluoridated. And if you go to their cities and their countries and study them, their teeth are at least as good, if not better, than the United States, which mm-hmm. is 74% fluoridated.
Right.
And also, they don't have problems with things like fluorosis, which is the pitting and discoloring right. of teeth right. from having too much fluoride in our bodies and systems.
So you probably wouldn't get too far if you went to the European Commission and said, okay, now we need to fluoridate Europe. You probably have a lot of mainstream scientists telling you you're crazy.
Exactly, yeah. They've done their research for many years, and most of them haven't fluoridated for decades now.
Yes, but I mean, there was a time where there was a higher percentage in Europe.
Yes.
And so it's retreated much.
They looked at the science very, very much in depth. Switzerland, Germany, France, all those countries, the Scandinavian countries, all really studied it deeply and intensively. And this is back 10, 20, 30 years ago for most of them. And they all just said, no, there's just too many risks, too many potential harms, and then the evidence isn't there for efficacy neither.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to see this, see the problems of teeth in children as kind of an outgrowth of diet. Well, I think it's pretty clear that that's a huge impact, and that this low-fat diet may have had the consequence of, by increasing carbohydrates, increasing sugar, also increased the tooth problems. I was thinking of that, even though we talked about it a while ago, because if we want to turn things around, it seems like diet is something that we have to
absolutely.
Really
and there's some change. Really good studies out there on sugar and cavities and caries, and it's incontrovertible. It's absolutely proven that sugar is the biggest cause.
Right, and I mean the problem with carbohydrates is they make you feel good in a short run. They're relatively cheap, mm-hmm. so if you're also dealing with income disparities, mm-hmm. lower income people are going to have a higher rate of they're not buying steaks for the barbecue, mm-hmm. right? They're going to be buying Kraft dinner mm-hmm. or donuts or things like that, which are relatively cheap way to feel good about the food that you're eating, even though
correct.
You know, often if you eat sugar, you don't feel so good an hour later. Mm-hmm. You need to go back for more, right? Which makes it even worse.
So your point on the poor kids, the euphemistically named group Calgarians for Healthy Kids that formed before this last civic election in Calgary in October of 2017, that's one of their major calling cards, one of the major points that they push. Oh, well, we have to do fluoridation for the poor kids.
Well, it seems like medicine likes a quick fix for everybody, and then they can get a lot of money out of a few.
Yeah.
As opposed to saying we should be putting a lot of emphasis in, say, poorer children so they can grow up healthy.
Absolutely. And one thing that really proves that point is Scotland's Child Smile program.
Mm-hmm.
Scotland does not allow fluoridation in their country. And they, like other countries in the developed world, started having more and more cavities and caries. And so in the early 2000s, they set about to rectify that. And so they formed the Child Smile program.
Mm-hmm.
And what that does is starts educating kids from the time they're 2 years old and up. And they teach them proper brushing, proper oral care. And so they're not only their the health of their teeth, but their oral health, and now even their total body health is taught properly. And so now with a decade and a half of information and results coming in, they can say definitively that they have far fewer caries and cavities than we have over here or the United
mm-hmm.
States has
mm-hmm.
in fluoridated areas.
Right.
Their rates of obesity, childhood obesity, which is huge around the world now, has gone down markedly. And so even you're looking even into cardiovascular diseases and total body effects. So Child Smile in Scotland has affected teeth, oral health, and total body health markedly.
It's nice
fluoridation.
Nice to hear that there's some things that people can do that actually work. Are there places in the world where fluoride has to be removed from the water?
Absolutely. China and India are two places mm. where they have very, in some places, have very high amounts of natural calcium fluoride. And if you get a lot of it in your water, then some of it will be absorbed, and yes, detrimental effects. Very severe fluorosis to the point that teeth are breaking down, becoming more brittle, and more and more cavities rather than less. Skeletal fluorosis, because about 50% of fluoride that we ingest is harbored in the bone. And so if too much is harbored in the bone, it causes fluorosis in the bone.
I've seen some old people in China who are bent double, and I've wondered if it was things like fluoride poisoning, which in China might be exacerbated by, you know, unregulated industrial developments that might also be...
I'm sure the industrial aspects exacerbate it, but I think probably a large majority of those would be mostly from fluoride or fluorosis.
So from areas where there was extremely high fluoride.
Yeah.
You've created a new organization called Safe Water Calgary. Mm-hmm. I mean, isn't your work done? There's no fluoride in the water now, so why do we need a new organization?
Well, unfortunately, the... powers that be continually try to influence councillors, influence politics and the political decision-making process. And ever since we got the fluoride out of the water, had it halted in May of 2011, they've been working diligently behind the scenes to try to get fluoride and fluoridation back in. And so this new group that was formed before the election, as I mentioned, Calgarians for Healthy Kids, went to every single candidate for council and for mayor, about 100 people in this prior to the October election last year, and pushed them, in some cases bullied and pressured them, and they actually came out with 63% of the candidates endorsing water fluoridation.
All right.
So there is a push to put it back in. Council has also been attacked for a long time by the press and by the powers that be, that are medical officers of health, dental officers of health, Alberta Health, saying that council was naive, that they were ignorant, that they were misinformed, that they made a decision just arbitrarily to take water fluoridation out in 2011. And so council has been given a pretty rough ride over the years. And to their credit, most of them have stood their ground. A couple of them succumbed to this big push from Calgarians for Healthy Kids in September and October last year.
Well, I got to say, it made it easier for me to choose a candidate to vote for, because
yes,
two of my potential candidates had putting fluoridation back in the water on their in their list of policies, and so I got rid of them, and there wasn't much left.
So there was left with, I think, in your writing, Drew Farrell.
Drew Farrell,
and she's been the leader in council for the last 15 years or more on anti-fluoridation. She's been very effective and very good, and has put a lot of time, energy, and effort into it, and also has taken a lot of flack press-wise.
Yes. I mean, even though I said that, you know, I think that the people who are opposed to fluoridation have changed, and there's now a lot more scientists and doctors and, you know, people with a long string of degrees and things like that than it used to be.
Unfortunately, not many in Calgary and
right.
Alberta.
But I think there's still kind of a feeling amongst progressive people who haven't really done any research that it's got to be good because it's scientific.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, I mean, I wonder if somebody's going to come up with putting arsenic in the water and how great that will be.
Or Prozac, because we've got a lot of pressure
right.
out there now.
There's
lots of opportunity
Prozac in the water, yeah. But I mean, it wasn't that long ago where we had medicines containing mercury and arsenic. I mean, mm-hmm. we still have, there's at least one medicine that contains arsenic still. Is it for yellow fever or something like that? Mm-hmm. Arsenophine, I can't pronounce it. And of course, we have mercury in vaccines. So we're still kind of pushing those things. But if you said, here's a new pill with mercury in it, people wouldn't take it.
Mm-hmm.
But these when people have decided something 50 or 100 years ago, it's very difficult to wash it out of the. It's almost like it's in the water, right?
Exactly. And if you look at the history of water fluoridation, in the late 40s and 50s, they hired industry, combination of industry, government, dental, and medical associations, hired Edward Bernays, Bernays. He wrote the book on spin doctrine and propaganda in for the 20th century. And he was the one that was hired by the tobacco companies in the 20s, 30s, 40s to convince doctors and women that smoking was good for them, particularly in pregnancy, because it calmed them down. So so the fluoridation industry saw the success that Edward Bernays had had with the tobacco industry, and they hired him to convince doctors and dentists that fluoride was good for kids.
I still remember, I think it must be in the 60s or 70s, when the feminist movement was just starting to get going, when a cigarette company sort of came out and said, "This is women's liberation, right? Now you get to smoke too."
That was probably in the 50s and 60s, I would think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're coming close to the end of our time, so is there anything else that you'd like to get out while we're still here?
The fact that fluorosis is not really gone overboard or over the top in Canada is a bit of a red herring. We're only 30% fluoridated in Canada now. And the United States, as I mentioned, is between 74% and 75% fluoridated.
Right.
And their rates of fluorosis, which is damage to the teeth from too much fluoride, has gone up to 58% this year with the NHANES total population studies in the States.
Right.
58% of teens have damaged teeth from fluorosis in the States.
Wow, that's...
Now, a lot of that is either very mild or mild, which usually doesn't have to be treated and probably is not problematic, although we don't know if it's happening to the teeth, it's also happening to other parts
of
the body.
Well, it's systemic, right? Like you, when you ingest water with fluoride, it's not just going in your teeth. You know,
exactly.
It's going into your body,
exactly.
And then ends up in the
And that's why there is some good information. There are some good studies. Topically, it can have some positive effects.
Mm-hmm.
But swallowed, it really is ineffective because of the low dose that actually contacts the teeth and the fact that it damages everything from the pineal gland to the neurological system to the thyroid gland to the kidneys, the bones, causes some cancers or potentially causes some cancers. If we could prove that definitively, it would be gone. But anyway, the fact that the fluorosis has gone up and the people back in the 50s and 60s said, we're never going to see fluorosis more than 10%. Well, it's 58% now in the States.
Yes. At what point do you say this is a problem? I guess the struggle in the United States, I follow a little bit the Fluoride Action Network. The struggle is ongoing in the United States.
Like, yes.
There's victories and there's losses.
Yeah.
I mean, has it gone down in the States from its 75%? Is that lower than it was?
No, or? it's continually going up.
It's continually
because
going
there's
up.
Millions and millions of dollars put into the pro-fluoridation campaigns by the Pew Foundation in the States, by Colgate, Johnson & Johnson, that have billions of dollars of profits coming out of fluoride and fluoride in toothpaste and rinses and mouthwashes and that sort of thing.
But, I mean, they still could sell fluoridated toothpaste even if there's no fluoride
but
in order.
But if fluoride gets a bad name,
right.
If water fluoridation gets a bad name, people equate that to fluoride, and then they're looking for toothpastes and other things that don't have any fluoride at all.
Right, right.
Just one last point that I could make. Calgarians for Healthy Kids, those are good people. I mean, they're trying to do good things.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're saying that, well, we have to do water fluoridation for the poor, particularly the poor kids, for the disadvantaged, because they're not getting the proper dental care, they're not getting proper nutrition. But sadly, it's the poor, the babies, children, the elderly, people of color, the disadvantaged, that are most profoundly affected by the side effects of fluoridation, starting with fluorosis of the teeth, but going to fluorosis of the skeleton, thyroid problems, drop in IQ. We can't afford 5 or 6 or 7 IQ point drops because that would essentially negate our society.
I mean, one of the things that surprised me, you mentioned feeding babies with formula.
Mm-hmm.
And it surprised me that there's lower rates of breastfeeding amongst the poor. I mean, that's an area where a big change could be made.
Education.
If we could educate people, provide support for breastfeeding for the poor, that would be beneficial in so many ways. I mean, for one thing, they don't have to buy formula, so it has an impact on their income. It has an impact on the health of the mother and the baby, including, obviously, the teeth, because you're not exposed... if it was fluoridated water, you wouldn't be exposed to that. But there's a lot of other reasons not to use infant formula. But if we want to improve, even the health of teeth, the baby's teeth are improved, I believe, by breastfeeding because of the it's better to have the mouth on a woman's, on a mother's breast than it is on a bottle.
Yes, like, exactly.
And so there's areas where we could make some difference. It would take a little bit more time and it would take a little bit more money maybe, but yes, it would actually help.
But the benefits would be huge down the road.
Right.
So that's why if we had a program similar to the Child Smile program in Scotland, we could do education beyond just the teeth, beyond
yes.
just the oral health.
Yes.
But total body health. And we could do things like, well, not just diet, but breastfeeding and all kinds of positive things could be educated on and rolled out to a much bigger audience.
Yes. Well, thank you for joining me today. Is there anything else you'd like to throw in as the last, famous last words?
I just have to say that it's not ethical or moral to mass medicate without control of dose or dosage, without following or monitoring, and without informed consent.
Thank you. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure, David.
Since I have a few minutes and we're talking about medical things with fluoridation, let's go through a little bit of medical news. One of the biggest new drug problems in the U.S. and Canada is the opioid epidemic. I'm sure that doesn't come as a surprise to you. This problem was started by Purdue Pharmacy that cynically promoted their OxyContin and oxycodone as less addictive alternatives to other opioids. There's a good expose in the New Yorker in October of 2017 if you want to find out all of this sordid story. Universities and museums around the world are now in the difficult position of deciding whether to accept money that was earned, if earned is the right word, through the destruction of so many lives. Pandora's box is open now, and even if legal opiates are made illegal, the problem won't go away. This was tried with heroin, which was invented by the Bayer Corporation in the 1800s, and it's still a problem, even though it's been illegal probably for close to a century. Opiates can be made in one country and shipped in regular mail all over the world. The chemicals are so potent that only small amounts need to be distributed to make a profit. Hence the overdose crisis, because buying drugs that are more potent than you think they are can be fatal. A January 25th, 2018 article in Canada's Globe and Mail newspaper was titled, "Ontario Sees Drop in Opioid Prescriptions." This is a not very funny joke, because looking at the graph, it's very difficult to see the drop. From 1.3 million new prescriptions in 2013 to 1.275 million new prescriptions in 2016. Although the definition of a new start to a prescription is a bit problematic. It's someone who hasn't filled an opioid prescription in the past 6 months. Given that people go to multiple doctors and pharmacies and probably use fake IDs, the numbers may not be entirely accurate. But they don't need to be, they are so huge. A reminder that Ontario is Canada's most populous province, with a bit over one-third of the total population of Canada. The problem is not limited to that one province, and of course, it's also prevalent in the United States. What are the solutions? Well, in Canada, we will see if legalization of marijuana, scheduled for July 2018 in Canada, will help. If people have cheap sources of pain relief, will they return to marijuana instead of opioids, with marijuana not being addictive? Will doctors start prescribing marijuana? I doubt too many will, because they are treated so much better by the pharmaceutical companies. The gravy train is very effective at keeping doctors on the expensive patented medications. Another solution would be legalization of the opioids, or at least decriminalization. At least that way, people would have access to opioids of predictable quality and concentration, and the risk of overdoses would go down. Also, the criminal gangs that become associated with the selling and shipping of opioids could be reduced, if not eliminated. Criminalization is not a solution. It never has been. Unfortunately, the criminalization industry benefits to the tune of billions of dollars thrown down this black hole by desperate governments, both in the armies, literally, that futilely intercept a tiny fraction of the tidal wave of drugs, and in the other armies that run the prisons that warehouse those that get caught. But why do people use drugs? Would you pop pills if someone put a dish of fentanyl on the table? From some of my previous interviews, I've concluded that drug addiction is a symptom of an underlying problem. It could be chronic physical pain, but also chronic emotional pain, hopelessness, loneliness, trauma from abuse, PTSD, things like that. And what do we do with these people? Instead of trying to deal with the root causes, too often we prescribe drugs and start them on a treadmill, essentially sending a message of hopelessness that you will never get better. There's something wrong with you that's never going to change, but you can manage it with drugs. What if we put the money into better schools, into safe and affordable childcare, into better paying and more meaningful work? Okay, maybe that's idealistic and we'll never achieve this nirvana, but in my opinion, we're going in the wrong direction. Work is becoming more and more meaningless, less and less meaningful. It's becoming more stressful and lower paying. While the 1%, which includes the owners of Purdue Pharmacy, certainly, they're maximizing their earning potential. But do they have meaning in their life? There's a new book out by Johann Hari on depression. He took antidepressants for 14 years, but he's no longer a fan of the drugs. So even though this is in many ways a mainstream book, he's supporting some of the ideas I just put forwards. Here's a quote from his book. "When I interviewed social scientists all over the world, I started to see an unexpected picture emerge. We all know that every human being has basic physical needs for food, for water, for shelter, for clean air. It turns out that in the same way, all humans have basic psychological needs. We need to feel we belong. We need to feel valued. We need to feel we're good at something. We need to feel we have a secure future. And there is growing evidence that our culture isn't meeting these psychological needs for many. I kept learning that in many different ways we've become disconnected from things we really need, and that this deep disconnection is driving this epidemic of depression and anxiety all around us." Between 2011 and 2012, the polling company Gallup conducted the most detailed study ever carried out of how people feel about the thing we spend most of our waking lives doing, our paid work. They found that only 13% of people are engaged in their work, 63% say they're not engaged, and 24% are actively disengaged. They hate it. Harry is connecting this to depression, but I think another outcome of people who aren't finding meaning in their lives would be drug addiction. And I think if people were asked if they had meaning in their lives with their family or friends, if they even have a family or friends that they're close to, we would also find problems with that as well. So dealing with the drug abuse problem is never going to get to the root cause of the problem. Why are people so unhappy? Thank you for listening to episode 173 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.